calls for change to our 16-year-old laws governing biotechnology. Could we see regulations around gene editing and genetic modification loosened? The Hazardous Substances and New Organisms Act, known as the HASNO Act, has not been substantially updated since the 2001 Royal Commission on Genetic Modification. The law tightly controls the use of gene engineering and genetically modified organisms. The Prime Minister's Chief Science Advisor, Dr. Juliet Gerard, says our current laws are not fit for purpose and should be overhauled. She's backed by the Royal Society, which has just issued a discussion document calling for an urgent discussion and debate about gene editing within and across all New Zealand communities. The Environment Minister, David Parker, has asked officials whether lower regulatory hurdles might be considered in some areas. Well, the National Party has pledged to review the Act if elected next year. Meanwhile, reforms in Australia have effectively deregulated gene editing in animals, plants and human cell lines that don't introduce new genetic material. We welcome the Prime Minister's Chief Science Advisor, Dr. Juliet Gerard. Good morning. Good morning also to Ag Research's Senior Scientist, Dr. Bjorn Obak. Hi, Bjorn.
Hello.
And also with a Senior Lecturer at the Bioethics Centre at the University of Otago, Dr. Mike King.
Good morning.
Good morning. Bjorn, I wonder if we could start with you, because this is something happening right now as research. Your research on developing a so-called smart cow, but particularly with a view to lowering methane emissions, which of course is a significant issue for New Zealand's climate change policy. What's actually happening right now at Ag Research?
So the project that we've just got approved for public funding is a five-year program into developing what we call climate smart cattle. So not the smart cattle, climate smart cattle. And that's basically around developing cattle that would fit the guiding principles of climate smart agriculture. And so these would be cattle that would be adapted to climate change, acknowledging that it is happening, acknowledging that there is global warming and changing the conditions. At the same time, we would also try to mitigate the effects of climate change by developing cattle that can perhaps reduce the emission of greenhouse gases. And then the third pillar of climate smart agriculture would be that we go and increase their productivity, sustainable. And so those two pillars of climate smart agriculture is what we try to essentially address with these climate smart cattle.
Can these traits be achieved through conventional breeding or through new feeds, which is also being investigated by Ag Research?
So if we look at the first two traits that we really focus on, which is around adapting cattle, dairy cattle, to global warming, those traits could be achieved by conventional breeding, absolutely. But it will take a long time. And so if you think about just introgressing one trait, one of those traits that is around heat tolerance, and this would be a trait around a particular coat of these animals, then one could use conventional breeding, and one would basically take many years to bring this into the right background. The advantage of doing it with genome editing is that we are able to essentially generate that one trait in a single generation. So it just accelerates things. It makes things a lot faster.
It makes them faster, but if you're going to have to argue the necessity and the urgency of of going through this again, as we did in 2001, and saying, look now is the time that we have to move, go through all those debates, all those different concerns, how do you make the case for necessity and urgency?
I think there's no point really to rehash old stereotypes in this debate, because the techniques that we're talking about now, the genome editing techniques, are fundamentally different in many ways from the traditional transgenic or genetically modified animal approaches that we've been using for a long time. And they differ in many ways. I mean, one of the crucial differences is that the variant that we introgress is a naturally occurring variant. This is a trait that exists naturally in this particular case in tropical beef cattle. And so bringing this naturally occurring trait into animals is fundamentally different from introducing a new trait. So that is a crucial difference. And to me, another crucial difference is, of course, also that those side effects that one can get with this technology are much diminished. I think it's a lot more precise than it used to be. So there's really not a big difference to conventional breeding, other than it's faster.
Where does the methane-lowering trait come from?
Oh, that comes a lot later. So methane is a complex problem. This is a very very important problem, clearly, for New Zealand's agriculture, given that, you know, sort of 80% of the emissions come from methane, and they account for 23% of the total greenhouse gas emissions of in the sector. But I think it's a difficult one. It's difficult because there's lots of genes involved, and we basically link with discovery programs, gene discovery programs, in New Zealand and across the world to identify some of those traits. Now, when they will be found eventually, I think the challenge of gene editing will entirely rely on heavy good causative, what we call causative variants or not, and how many are there. The more there are, the more difficult it will be to use genome editing for that. But I don't think it's intractable. I think it is possible.
What's actually involved? And just listening to you, it sounds like it can be a fairly simple piece of editing and insertion, or it can be complex. And what are you doing right now? And, so what and doing how?
So what we're doing right now is we're basically taking two target variants that are, we think, promising for adapting dairy cattle to climate change. One is around the coat, the actual what they call the slick coat, and the other one is around coat color. So this is to reduce radiative heat gain in animals. So you think about animals that are black and white. You know, the more black they are, the more difficult, or the more they suffer from heat stress. And we want to lighten the coat color. So those two are variants that are known and that are naturally occurring in cattle populations.
So what do you do to achieve it, though? What's the actual technique?
The technique that we use is what we call embryo-mediated genome editing. And it's crucial that it's embryo-mediated because we want to bring those two variants, known variants, onto an elite genetic background. So we do that with embryos that are genetically high value. And so we have developed techniques over many years to be able to predict the genetic value of a cow or a bull from an early embryonic stage when the embryo is only about a week old. And so we can identify those embryos, and then we want to overlay the genome edits into those elite backgrounds. And that's something that we have already demonstrated with another trait a couple of years ago. We're actually the first group to do that worldwide, to do this precise genome editing. And what that means technically is we'll inject embryos with those genome editors, we'll grow them for a week, then we'll take a sample, a tiny little biopsy of those embryos, we determine the genetic value of those embryos, and then we'll find out whether or not they have been successfully genome edited.
So it happens so by an injection rather than a sort of a cut and splice approach. It happens by injecting and seeing if they take hold, essentially.
So the cut and splice happens after the genome editors have been injected into the embryo. And so once they've injected, they do their thing. So the genome editor will cut the DNA, and that is fundamentally editogenic. So it creates a break in the DNA. And that break signals to the repair system in the DNA to, okay, now repair this. And then we'll help a little bit. We provide a little template that tells the cell how to repair its DNA. And the repair template contains the specific change. In our case, one of them is just the one base pair change that we want to introduce.
So you give instructions. I mean, I think as an old-fashioned radio type that we used to cut and stick a piece of tape together. But what you do is create the break in the DNA, and then you've got a set of instructions. The cell goes into its repair, and if it follows your instructions, you have your new material.
Okay. Correct. Yeah.
Is this reproducible? Will it mean that animal, therefore, when it gives birth to the next generation, this genetic material will be passed on?
Absolutely. You know, and so there's a study that has just exemplified that with a trait that is, I think, very useful from an animal welfare point of view called the polled trait. So these are cattle that are genetically dehorned, and they have shown that this trait, introduced by genome editing a few years ago, will be passed on just like any other Mendelian trait, and it will be, you know, segregating in the offspring just like any other gene.
What are the difficulties of taking this further? Let's come to methane, where, of course, everyone is looking for solutions. From what I've heard from you, at the point at which you're breaking the DNA and trying to introduce the new traits, you've probably got a lot of balls in the air, and you're trying to give instructions to the DNA repair to do a whole lot of things.
Yes,
I can understand how that would be both harder. Does it also introduce risks around side effects or unintended consequences?
Well, unintended consequences can never be excluded. You know, clearly this will happen. So if you think about unintended consequences, we'll have to compare it to something else. And so what has been done in the past, you know, conventional breeding, is that you sort of randomly mutagenize the genome. You know, you can use chemicals for that, you can radioactive for that. And this is a very much a random approach, and that will generate mutations. Now, with this particular approach here, we also generate some mutations. You create those double strand breaks. But they don't seem to exceed what we observe during normal background mutation. This is something that happens all the time. People, sort of have this idea that the genome is static, but it's not. It's constantly being repaired. And there will always be mutations that arise naturally. And the mutations that we create artificially, you know, through this particular technology, are not really different from those that, you know, happen naturally. And from what we know from sequencing whole genomes of many different genome-edited animals, they don't seem to be very problematic either. They seem to be very specific, these technologies.
I suppose sometimes, though, when there has been DNA damage and repair is happening, can't we, even in the course of a normal animal life, see disease result? And particularly because the epigenetics, the instructions that are going, that are happening as part of the reseal of the repair process, can become faulty. So is this an issue when you are beginning to either speed things up or do more at once, you have the potential to have that kind of side effect? This is going to be part of the research.
I think that is very important. The question you asked is very important in the context of trying to edit a large number of targets. So far, we haven't really been doing that. We've been doing one or two, so this is what we start with. But if we talk about complex trait, these quantitative traits that are really important for livestock breeding, then we're going to have to really assess what could happen if we do, for example, edit 10 genes at the same time. So this is a bit futuristic at the moment to do that. But yes, this is a very interesting research question,
so
what will happen then.
This goes to the heart of, do you lower some regulations on a case-by-case basis rather than just lifting the lid so that there's a free-for-all. What else is happening at Ag Research that shows promise? I think there's one, I'm not sure if it's your something particularly familiar with, but there's some research going on with pigs that could result, for example, in human transplants for things like eyes. What else is happening?
Yeah, so the project that I talked about with the climate smart cattle is one that's firmly in the agricultural space. The one that you refer to with the pigs, that's an interesting one that's sitting in what we call the agri-medical space. So this is around essentially using a unique genetic resource from New Zealand, these Auckland Island pigs, which are naturally free of a number of porcine pathogens, including particular type of porcine endogenous retroviruses. And what we want to do with those ones is to essentially remove some of the antigens that are crucial for immune rejection. Again, this is a relatively small number of target genes. In this case, we're talking about four different genes that encode enzymes that produce those antigens. And we then want to essentially use those for xenotransplantation. So this is the idea of growing pigs as a source of organs for transplantation, and we're focusing on the kidney. So two different streams of research.
What do the regulations allow you to do now? The HasNo and Act allow you to do now, and what do they limit?
Right, under current New Zealand legislation, genome editing of livestock is clearly classified as GM, and it is regulated under the HasNo Act. So that means we have to have all the necessary regulatory approvals to develop and maintain those genome edited cattle. And we do that. We have a large facility. It's approved by the Environmental Protection Agency, a large animal autocontainment unit. And this is something that, is essential for our research. So we are able to do that. But what we would really like to do in the future, I think, is that we somehow facilitate and simplify this process. So we're talking about, in the end, if we want to use this for agricultural purposes, we need release. Clearly, of those animals at some stage, they need to go and be used. That's the whole point of
it. So is it a case of moving to field trials, which is often controversial with crops because it's so difficult to prevent pollination spreading? Is it a case of field trials, or will the next step for you be simply being able to use whatever we achieve?
At the moment, it's just research, but ultimately, yeah, field trials. I think the problem that you have with plants about, you know, pollination and containment is much reduced when you deal with dairy cows. You know, they don't really jump the fence and just, you know, distribute, you know, with the wind. So it's very simple to contain them. But we're doing two different approaches. We at the same time, at some point, we want to get this technology clearly approved in New Zealand. At the same time, there are countries globally that are a lot more open, I think, to these new technologies, that really embrace them. And if we're talking about climate smart cattle, clearly there's an application for this overseas as well. And so we're thinking about geographies that are, like in South America, that are more open to this.
Your ag research, you're a research institute in the primary sector. So
yep.
Your title is very relevant here, but you are working for yep. the sector. And whether it's conventional breeding is one thing, but I'm curious as to whether there are discussions, even within your organisation, about yep. the economic and other impacts of changing New Zealand's status. Just on Friday, we had an interview that talked about the... this was with Gary Hirschberg, who built the world's largest organic dairy company from nothing, from seven cows in a paddock. And is yep. highlighting New Zealand's potential as a leader. He is talking about the rapid growth in demand that that sector is experiencing. Is yep. this economic question in some ways almost the hardest one, that you can't be a little bit genetically modified? In the case of what you're doing, can you argue that you can?
I think this might sound a bit controversial, but I don't think that organic and GE are necessarily mutually exclusive, because clearly the idea behind the technologies that we are developing are to increase sustainability. This is to reduce environmental footprint. This is really, environmental issues are the driver for this. And the urgency around climate change has accelerated this. Now, that's not so different from, you know, some of the organic principles. And so I'm thinking, you know, there needs to be a little bit less of this sort of ideological confrontation that has dominated the field for a long time.
Is it different with crops, where pollination is an issue and preventing so-called contamination is an issue?
Yeah, it's more difficult from a containment point of view. And it's very interesting that genome modified animals have been around for a lot longer, at least, you know, basic research-wise, compared to, you know, crops, you know. But they are still a lot more difficult to get market access.
Thank you, Dr. Bjorn Obak. Stay with us if you're able to. AgriResearch senior scientist who is working on this $10 million study attempting to create cattle that produce more milk, create fewer emissions and have greater heat tolerance. The latter is the first target by the sounds of it. 26 minutes past nine, it is on 9 to noon. Let's welcome in the Prime Minister's Chief Science Advisor, Dr. Juliet Gerard. Juliet, you've basically said that these current laws, which are dated now, 2001, are not fit for purpose. What do you... Just elaborate on that. What is it preventing?
Well, I think, as you just heard, it's slowing things down quite a lot. So it's not that we can't do things. It's that scientists are very frustrated because if they want to take an organism all the way from the laboratory into field trials and then maybe out... into the real world, if you like, then it's very slow. And the old tools you can use much more swiftly and efficiently than the new tools in terms of the regulatory barriers, which doesn't seem to match. So you can introduce lots of random changes with a lower regulatory barrier than the new precise tools, which doesn't seem logical.
What has changed since 2001? We heard from Bjorn about the actual techniques of gene modification changing, becoming more precise. What else has changed, either on the demand side, the potential for what this could be used for, or on the issues around safety and security?
I think one important point that tends not to come out in the debate is that everybody's focused on the Has-No Act. But one of the things that's changed is that some of the experiments we're doing are crossing domains and therefore crossing different legal territory. So part of the Royal Society work was to look at all the different acts, so the Medicines Act, the Human Tissues Act, all the acts that control biosecurity or the primary industries, and to start to look at all the definitions in those acts. So one of the problems is that pest is defined in a different way in different acts. And another, which is really crucial, is that new organism is defined in different ways in different acts. So, for example, in the Medicine Act, you define human tissue in one way and it has no act in another way, which just frustrates the whole thing. And as the technologies have evolved, you've, for example, got medical research where you want to take cells out of a patient through the lab and back into the patient. And so you're crossing all those different acts, which really frustrates the scientists as they have to navigate this very complicated framework when they'd really like to be doing their research more efficiently.
What's the potential in human medicine? A realistic potential in New Zealand. We'll talk a little bit more about what's happening in some parts of the world. But right now, with what our researchers are doing, what is the potential of using currently not legal processes in clinical trials or in actual treatments?
If we can just broaden slightly, I think the gene editing report really raised questions that apply to any new technology. And so there's been a very recent example that just made it through the regulatory framework coming from the Malagan Institute to do a CAR T-cell anti-cancer trial. And that is exactly the scenario that I just described, where they take cells out of a patient, do something to them genetically, and then put them back into the patient.
No new material introduced, right? And the patient's own material is reintroduced.
Yeah, let's, for the sake of argument, assume there's no new material. They still hit all these different acts. And so it's absolutely the case, and people will argue that, yeah, the clinical trial is now going ahead. But a huge part of the challenge for the researchers was navigating the regulatory framework, where what I think we should be focusing on is the bioethics and whether these experiments have benefits that outweigh the risks. There'll always be benefits, there'll always be risks. I think we need to shift the focus so that we're looking at the questions, which can be across so many different domains, rather than obsess about whether we've made a new organism or not, according to some old and precise legal definition.
What needs to happen then, again with human medicine in mind, what needs to happen and could happen, in your view, relatively uncontroversially, if something like this has been approved, having gone through a very complex system, what could be a quite straightforward set of reforms to the law that would reach the same decision, the same outcome, but with a heck of a lot less hassle?
There's two main things, I think, and I'll refer people to the legal section of the Royal Society report and an expanded version of that paper that I think is about to be published in the Victoria University Legal Review. And there they've gone through, this is Julie Everett Hinks and Mark Hannigan, they've gone through all the acts, all the definitions, and just put forward a list of considerations. So some of those are as simple as changing the definition of a human cell in the Has No Act. Some require just a few tweaks so that people can quickly navigate across the different acts. And then there's a more substantive piece of work if we want to open the can of worms of looking at the Has No Act itself. But I think there's some low-hanging fruit that we could very quickly do just by tweaking some of the definitions and the regulatory frameworks between these different acts that people are now navigating way more than they did when they were all written.
So that sounds like the low-hanging fruit. What are the more complex issues that would more fundamentally challenge the principles of the Has No Act? What has actually been allowed or not been allowed till now? Please give us again an example of the potential if there were to be reform of that act.
Yeah, I think people have got very locked into a few arguments. So is it a new organism? Isn't it a new organism? And is genetic editing, genetic modification or not? And I'm not sure that's helpful. So I think if we could shift to a framework where we're looking more at the degree of modification, and we're in an era now where we know if mistakes are made during these processes, we can sequence the whole genome and see what mistakes were made, so we could have all that in place. We could get to a stage where in different domains people were maybe applying different thresholds, and in different institutions even you could. So you could imagine a situation where inside containment the regulations were lifted quite extensively because the containment itself is mitigating against any risk. In health you might have a lower barrier, and for things where there might be trade implications or ethical issues that people want to really look at, there might be a higher hurdle. But this one size fits all, is it or isn't it a new organism, is it or isn't it GM, I think is really stifling the important questions that we should be focusing on.
Will we find ourselves, if that fundamental question is addressed and instead is changed to a case-by-case assessment of the extent of the change and the pros versus the cons, will we be getting into areas with very real potential right now, such as eliminating inherited diseases? And is Is that going from low-hanging fruit to the top of the tree, or is it somewhere in the middle? Like, what are the gnarly conversations going to be around?
I think things like the inherited diseases is probably one of the places in legislation where we're best served in terms of ethics committee being already in place. So for things like embryo treatments and things, we're used to having those conversations. I think the complicated bit and the thing that we need to look at is where tools are coming out of one domain and entering another. So one example would be to have a single entry point for all these genetic modifications. So there's a skilled group of people who can look at the problem from all sorts of different angles, the science, the health, the ethics, the costs, the benefits, the economics, and bring those people together. But at the moment, they're not all in one place.
What do you believe public tolerance is for many of the potential medical or pharmaceutical therapies right now? Do you believe there's probably a very high tolerance for a lot of the practical stuff that researchers are working on or could be working on?
Again, I don't think there's a one-size-fits-all answer. So I'm reasonably confident that if it's a cure for cancer, most people are going to be happy to try it. And I think there was evidence right back as far as the Royal Commission that found the public were comfortable with genetic modification for medical purposes, where we were curing someone and not in any way modifying the germline. And I think similarly, if you look what played out in China with the modification of those human twins by GE, most people were outraged. And that's why we need an ethics committee to look case by case. There's going to be costs, there's going to be benefits. Everyone's going to have their own line of comfort. But at the moment, I think the rules are so strict that people are putting their energy into trying to get over the barriers and the boundaries rather than actually focusing on the important question of what's right.
Are you talking about a single new act that might have implications for other specific acts, like the Medicines Act, but one fundamental new act that crosses the various areas where gene editing or other modifications might apply, and a smaller expert process that can work across them, perhaps hauling in experts when it needs them.
So I'm not a lawyer. I'm the science advisor. So I'll try and stick to my knitting in terms of science advice. I have talked to Julie Everett Hinks and Mark Hannigan, who wrote that legal paper. They have thought about it very hard, and I'd recommend you get them on to talk through the details. But they talk about a single point of entry where if a particular experimental clinical trial is going to hit all these different acts, there's a place to have the debate.
Pest control is also one where the science might do one thing, but public tolerance might be somewhere else. And we've had research going into affecting the fertility of possums, for example. Do you have a comment, either scientifically, on what's possible? Do you envisage this also coming to the one-stop shop?
That would be a really good example of something that would need to come to the one-stop shop, because that's one of the poster children in the Royal Society reports. I think there are 10 acts and 4 different regulating authorities for any release of an organism that might be useful in pest control. Scientifically, I think this one's been thrown around as a bit of a political football for not particularly good reasons. So we're a very long way from any technology that might wipe out possums, for example. If you look at the Royal Society report again, they put some time frames on those things. We're in decades, probably. The only organism that's maybe close to being wiped out by that technology is the mosquito. And again, you can see risks, especially in a time of a biodiversity crisis, of releasing any type of technology that could remove a species. But if there is one species globally that you might get consensus to remove, it would maybe be the mosquito, again, because of all the health consequences with that population. So this is one where people are talking about decisions in the now, where we've actually probably got 10 years to work out whether this is something that we could regulate and something that we would want to do.
Has there been implications for that actual research, though, the stringency of the regulations that we have in New Zealand, or perhaps the reluctance to do anything about them? Has that inhibited the research that is going on the possum front?
I haven't talked to the people that want to do that particular piece of research, but in general, I think the huge regulatory barriers for some of these technologies is bound to slow people down or take them offshore. So again, we need an easy way to decide which experiments to do, when we have the debate, which I think should be sooner rather than later, and certainly way ahead of the technology being ready for release, and then look at making the decision framework easier so that we can spend our energies on the important questions that we need to answer.
How radical is what Australia has done, radical with respect to opening the field?
Yeah, they've come up with a compromise where they've said that gene editing, if it doesn't introduce new genetic material, can have a lower regulatory hurdle. That seems like, on the face of it, a very sensible compromise. We'd have to look through all the different trade implications and what that does for exports of different organisms, but that's certainly one to follow closely.
Thank you very much, Juliet. And listening in also, as we said, Dr. Mike King of the Bioethics Centre at the University of Otago, Senior Lecturer there. Mike, good morning.
Good morning.
Could you comment on what you've heard so far by means of possible reform? So Juliet's referred fairly heavily to the Royal Society report. Is there anything proposed in that reform that bioethicists would urge caution around?
Well, some certainly would. You know, there's a diverse range of views amongst bioethicists on this, as well as amongst the public. But I want to thank the Royal Society for having done this work, and Juliet for raising it with government as well. We used to have the Bioethics Council in New Zealand that would look at these kinds of things. That was created from the Royal Commission. It was one of the recommendations of the Royal Commission that the then Labor government picked up on and followed through on, which was reversed by the National government in 2009. So since about 10 years ago, we haven't been having this national discussion about it, and it's really good that the Royal Society has filled that gap a little bit. The main thing is 20 years ago, it was quite a different problem that we were dealing with. It was mainly focused around interspecies gene transfer, and so there was a whole lot of concern about frankenfoods, you know, this kind of crossing species boundaries. The technology was imprecise. It was expensive. Partly the science was expensive, but also the regulations were really expensive. And so you had, you know, these kinds of things were going to be done by basically big corporations if they were going to be done at all. And so that's what happened. And these led to all sorts of objectionable consequences of the technology, you know, with Roundup ready crops and all of that kind of thing, where people were very doubtful about the benefits. And what we're seeing now is quite a different discussion. I think that's come across in the discussion so far. There's a different discussion partly because the techniques are different, and partly because the benefits are seen as more clear and salient to people. And the risks are the sorts of things that we have a little bit of a better handle on, but there are some new risks that come along as well.
A couple of observations. I won't ask you to comment on the first because we've already touched on it. We're already getting emails coming in from people who are organic growers, particularly vegetable growers. That's an economic issue. That's an issue of branding. That's a question of whether, as our agriculture perhaps comes under pressure as a commodity business in the coming decades, and there are plenty of reports warning that we may be looking to move to the premium end of the market, and perhaps the best dollars and some of the highest growth of demand might be wealthier countries looking for organic products. So let's just leave that sitting there as one complication. Let's look at the ethics of it. And some of your own colleagues at the University of Otago were calling for a much more robust system of ethical governance in response to the human gene editing issues that happened in China that Juliet referenced. Are we in a situation where we need to bring in regulations that anticipate not the conversations we've been having this morning, but the other possibilities? And would any regulatory regime need to bear in mind the need, I guess, to stay in control of who is doing what and why?
Yeah, well, I mean, the problem that was exposed in China was partly that we are now in a, you know, much more a sort of a global science environment. And also these technologies are far easier to use in a precise kind of way than the old technologies. And so you can have these rogue actors that can occur. Now, in that case, China there was quite significant condemnation even within China for that. But we need to try and grapple with the fact that this is an easier technology to use. And so to a certain extent, we have to be highly responsive to that. And when regulation is really sort of insensitive to what looks like some ethically salient features of the new technology, then that will increase people's frustration. And that can be the frustration of the scientists, but also frustration of people who stand to benefit, or people, the environment, or animals, if they stand to benefit from these kinds of technologies.
Thank you all. There's more we could discuss, but we need to leave it there this morning. I'm sure we'll be back to it. I really appreciate your contributions, Dr. Juliet Gerard, Dr. Bjorn Obeck, and Dr. Mike King.